Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our Sweet Ops community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. It's September 27th, 2023. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by using our 200 plus Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 10 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup build a reliable, modern, scalable infrastructure, transform ClickOps into a well-oiled DevOps machine, leverage our open source, rock solid Terraform blueprints. And the result, you launch better products faster, free up your bandwidth for innovation, and nail your value delivery every time. And if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success for you. Worst case, you get a clear roadmap for shoring up your infrastructure. Best case, we co-build it with you and empower your DevOps team in 90 days or less. Now, how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format's very informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Just join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse or send us a short testimonial about the value you're getting in Slack. Just go to slack.cloudposse.com. Remember, we're not simply just creating content here. We're building a community. So with that said, let's get started. Here's the news for the week that I found interesting. All right. First, for those of you who've been using Splunk over the years, now they've officially been acquired by Cisco for a whopping $28 billion. So it's a pretty big chunk of change. Curious to see how this acquisition goes. And if Cisco does a good job with it. Anyone have any interesting takeaways from this? All right. Next announcement, ClickHouse. They have open sourced a Zookeeper alternative that's been written from the ground up in C++. Apparently, they've been leveraging it pretty intensively and reached some of the scaling limits or made it difficult, that were difficult to scale with a Java runtime. So this is a lot more efficient, uses a whole lot, a whopping 46 times less memory, not surprising, and a higher transaction volume. Made me think, was it another product that just implemented like Zookeeper on top of S3 or something? I felt like we had an announcement like that recently.
Kafka itself has removed Zookeeper as a dependency.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That, maybe that's what it was. Kafka on S3. Maybe it was, I think somebody had written part of the wire protocol of Kafka so that you could use S3 instead, but it's not coming up here.
Everyone hates Zookeeper. That's all I know.
Yeah. All I remember was one of the easier things to set up compared to other things like Kafka.
I know. Why does everyone hate it so much?
Kafka, on the other hand, I just remember having lots of issues with it on dynamic IPs and trying to set that up in an auto-scaling kind of way. Venkat, looks like you've had some experience with that.
Yeah, I think, just don't recommend it.
You lose some hair.
Another minor announcement. EKS now supports 1.28. These are so regular now. It's boring. another attack to be wary of. Kind of smart one. So some groups are imitating Dependabot PRs, trying to sneak in GitHub Actions that'll exfiltrate the secrets of repositories. So it's not a problem unless you merge that PR. But if you merge that PR, your secrets are belong to them. Next one. Oh, this was a good one. Thanks, Jeremy Grodberg, for sharing it. So there's been some bad press, you could say, for Okta, though it's not really Okta's fault at all. It's just that Okta is the go-to single sign-on provider that a lot of companies or identity providers that a lot of companies use. So a couple of major breaches, notably the ones that just happened in Vegas affecting MGM. I'm not sure if Caesars was the same vector, but they were a result of user credentials getting compromised. Not any fault of Okta's. They were either like available on a thin client or obtained some other way. But the MFA credentials were compromised. How were they compromised? Well, one of two attacks. And they talk about how this is relatively easily done. And while in principle, MFA should make it basically impossible for anybody to impersonate you, it's actually quite interesting how easy it is for it to fail when it fails. So one way they talk about is basically if you over MFA fatigue attacks, you trigger these things to go off in the middle of the night. So the, the on-call engineer is getting, bombarded by authenticate, approve this login. And like, rather than just figure out what's going on, they just hit, okay, approve, accept, okay, go on, and I'll go back to bed, and those things stop. And now the attacker is in because they already had the credentials. The other attack is with a man-in-the-middle attack for MFAs. So if they somehow get the admin to click on a link from a text message or something else, enter their credentials through there, they can get the temporary MFA password that way, immediately use it by sending it through their proxy and then to the service and then passing the token further on to them, for example, the JOT token. So that's what they talk about here.
There was a third method that everybody should be aware of, and it involved if you imagine setting up a TOTP authenticator, an MFA, mm-hmm. on a mobile device. Some services, and they specifically called out Google Authenticator as supporting a method of enrolling a second mobile device by combining the first version, by getting the user to share the token. If you can do multiple tokens, there's a method by which you could create the same MFA generator, TOPT generator, on your own mobile device. So the attackers created, they cloned the MFA TOTP account through a feature that was intended for end users to clone to another device.
And the same is true of 1Password and most of these systems. TOTP is just a like a signed URL. It's not even assigned. It's just a URI with some parameters and a seed, basically, where to start that sequence on. So it's game over. If you get that,
done.
Yep. MFA has no value. It's just been cloned. I mean,
so
I'm
web often
that one, like. Mm-hmm. Because we recommend it at Cloud Posse for shared MFA for like admin for admin accounts like on AWS. Now AWS supports multiple authenticators on the root accounts, though that is also a little bit harder to instrument, I think, from an automation perspective. So we've still been recommending the shared root account credentials in a secure vault for a select number of people.
Yep. And we prefer WebAuthn as our number one MFA choice in order to address some of these challenges with TOTP. But it's not always an option.
Yeah.
With WebAuthn, are you folks using passkeys or are you folks using hardware keys?
So many, they come in different, we hear different terms, security keys, passkeys, hardware tokens, and there's some overlap, but the principal deployment of that for us is YubiKeys. But there's YubiKeys, OnlyKeys, but it's all WebAuthn that we're leveraging is the fundamental protocol that we're preferring for that. You know, Microsoft Hello and Touch ID are all forms of security keys that speak WebAuthn. So YubiKey speaks WebAuthn. WebAuthn is ultimately what I'm really talking about, but it's referred to by many different terms. A hardware token is ultimately the concept that I'm going for, and any hardware token system that works requires support for multiple hardware tokens. Every user that we have uses more than one. You have a backup physical key, but you also rely on acknowledgement or recognition if that hardware key is ever stolen. So I manage five keys, physical keys, and I use them on all my accounts, just as an example. But the typical user in our environment that's using them is only using two keys, one that they keep locked up as a backup in case the key is damaged.
That makes sense. It's annoying then when services don't let you register more than one. But if you can register more than one on an account, then I support the hardware keys.
I haven't found too many anymore that don't. But no. there are some services that require you to first enable TOTP, and then they support. There's several of them that do that. They won't allow you to add a hardware token until you've added either SMS or TOTP first.
I think Google and GitHub are both like that, if I'm not mistaken. Really?
That's kind of ironic because those are both weaker protocols. So you have to enable these weaker workarounds.
However, with GitHub, I believe if you enable, I tested this out with passkeys a few weeks ago. If you enable WebAuthn, apologies if I got the term wrong, but if you enable the other layer, not just TOTP, you can set your default to be the WebAuthn, like the newer one. So you can basically get the prompt immediately for your hardware token versus the TOTP. And ideally, if you do that, you won't get the autofill-in that most of our password managers do by default.
All right. Next announcement. Interesting one. So Harness has come out with their own GitHub competitor. I say that in air quotes because obviously GitHub is an enormous product, and I doubt that this open source alternative is a feature complete with that. But what I think it is interesting about that is if you look at GitLab introducing pipelines, Bamboo and Bamboo pipelines, GitHub and now GitHub Actions, there's a pattern here. And I think they want to create a tighter ecosystem with the VCS. And in order to do some of the things that maybe Harness wants to do, maybe they're creating their own, you know, GitHub alternative for this reason.
I thought GitEA, G-I-T-E-A, was supposed to be the alternative.
For a long time, it has been a lightweight one. But again, it's so much more, right? Hosting a web-based version of Git, that's not a big deal. It's when you want to try and add all the other things around it, code owners and branch protections and teams and, now maybe Harness or other automation like that.
Yeah.
It was also raised that there really hasn't been a open source alternative that's come out for a long time, pretty much since GitLab. Now, between GitLab and GitEA, I'm not sure which one, came first or second.
I haven't deployed GitEA, but it looked pretty compelling. I thought there was some level of action support. So this feels...
Really?
Yeah, I thought there was. Maybe I read it wrong.
Wow.
There's no code spaces, that's for sure, but... Yeah, I haven't used this, but I'll have to dig into
that. That's cool. I didn't know that at all. That's cool.
Yeah, it looked like it had some good corporate sponsors behind it. I think even, might be mistaken on this, because Atlassian also owns Bitbucket.
But no way.
I think this behind this as well.
Too funny. It's based on ACT. ACT is like the self-hosted GitHub Action runner that, like, if you wanted to run GitHub Actions locally, you can use it. It's close, but not a cigar, or whatever the expression goes, close, but no cigar. Like, when you use ACT, you get a GitHub Actions-like experience, except for half the time, those actions you develop under ACT don't actually work on GitHub Actions.
But in this case, they'll work in Git, yeah, right?
Yeah, it'll work in Git, I guess. Yeah, exactly. So, which would be a nice, I think, pattern. Get things first, working first locally as a CLI, as open source, with something like that as a service, and then make it integrate into the product. Instead of building it integrated to the product and figure out, wait, how are we going to do this locally again? Anyone using Gitia or kick the tires on this and the actions?
Yes, I use Gitia at home.
Oh, you do?
I use it mainly for automated backups of configs, like my firewall configs and stuff like that. It's real nice to, from my phone, be able to pull up a visual diff real easily while I'm on the go. If there's a configuration setting change or something like that, I have a bunch of Git-backed configuration. And it's real nice to be able to see that in a web page and, you know, do a visual element of a diff dash Y before after stuff on the fly. Because obviously I could shell in and do it. But when you're driving down the road, it's nicer to click through that.
Yeah, makes sense.
Of course, I don't need all the automation around it. So I'm not really using the GitHub. If I were looking at actions, I'd look at Concourse or something like that, because it integrates pretty easily with that as well. But I've never looked at using it to replace GitHub Actions.
Yeah, I've used Gitia in air-gapped environments, but never used any actions either.
Gotcha. All right, now let's see. Next announcement was just a small one. Previously, AWS didn't support blocking AMIs from public access. Unless you explicitly marked an individual image that way, like as a policy in an account, you could accidentally therefore leak AMIs with sensitive IP. So this is a welcome change to just blanket disallow any form of public AMIs from being created inside of an account. This one was shared with me. It looked pretty nice. Obviously, there's a whole lot more to Datadog than just observability, logs, metrics, traces, and so forth. But as an self-hosted open source alternative, it checks the box on some of the critical things by tying those together, making it easier to set up and use. I don't know how it scales. Don't know for what scale it was built for. But cool. Oh, interesting. Backed by a YC company. I have to say the latest HashiCorp business with Terraform and its products has put a sour taste in my mouth with companies starting with open source only then to change their licensing. All right. Final announcement. Yeah, as you heard, OpenTofu was released at open source conference in Bilbao last week. If you are interested in trying out OpenTofu before they have official releases, those should be coming soon, but they're not available yet. Scalar has a nice little blog post here on how to get it set up. Just clone the repo, run go build, and voila, you got OpenTofu. That should be using the OpenTofu registry. So you shouldn't, I believe that will ensure that you're not violating any licenses. That registry is online, but I don't know too much more about it than that. Anyways, cool. So that's the end of my announcements. Anyone have any other announcements? Checking out the chat here.
I have some great news.
Do share.
Yeah, Terraform provider for Domino's didn't support carryout, and I just got an MR merged in, and now it does.
Nice. Thanks for the contribution. The world of demos.
I was testing it and I ordered a pizza at 11:30 p.m. last night and then was like, shit, now I have to go pick up a pizza.
That's cool. All right. Any other announcements? All right. Well, that's it. Let's jump into Q&A. Oops, wrong button. All right. Any questions we can get answered today? Let me check out the office hours Slack.
Argo, has anyone ever used Argo CD as a replacement for GitHub Actions? Argo Workflows. Apologies. Argo Workflows as a CI engine. Has anyone used that? And thoughts, opinions, success?
I haven't used it as a full replacement. I did some testing with it. It looked pretty cool, but it also looked like it was pretty immature when I looked at it about 2 years ago. I think it's come a long way since then, but I think it was struggling to just have some basic authentication set up. So can't really speak to it, but it looks pretty powerful. For what it's worth, there's a company that does some data cataloging software that uses it in their backend. Your sales engineer will tell you about it. And so it's being used in production, but not necessarily in a GitHub Actions type of format, but more for embedded into an existing data product.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think they're very catered towards like ML ops or like data pipelines because they have like, you know, DAGs and things like that. So, yeah, thank you.
What is your primary driver for looking for an alternative? Just curious.
That's a pretty funny question because I'm talking to GitHub sales right now. And essentially, GitHub, you know, we know that GitHub has incidents, right? I don't know, for some reason, it just seems to be a more common occurrence. I don't know if that's just me though, but you know, our developers are basically kind of asking to see if maybe there's any way we can improve the reliability, which obviously you can't control GitHub. So either utilizing GitHub Enterprise Server and host it yourself, or use the hybrid approach, which I don't know what that even looks like in terms of authentication and like DR and whatever. But ultimately, if it's like, hey, we'll just do our own CI, right? And then just remove that reliance altogether rather than having like these kind of workflows and authentication that points at your GitHub server versus running actions on the enterprise server versus using GitHub Actions runner controller and Kubernetes. So it's like maybe another approach is to just, you know, try something else.
Yeah. Keep in mind now you're in charge of all of that. And I think it's a slippery slope. GitHub Enterprise Server is probably interesting. However, it also lacks a lot of feature parity with GitHub Cloud or GitHub.com. So be aware of that.
Yeah, that I was reading through the docs about that. You know, they say that they have native action support, which sounds interesting. But even then, it's, you know, there's a scaling problem, right? If you just have like 3 or 4 servers as HA, we would still probably use like actions controller runner in mm-hmm. Kubernetes. So at that point, it's like we're mainly just doing it so we don't have to rely on their APIs. But yeah, you bring up a good point about, you know, supporting whatever cloud has, as well as the migration process does not look easy. It is not it is non-trivial.
How big is the company? Like we talked about before, like, you know, what scale does it make sense to host your own Prometheus and all of that stuff? It's like, at what scale does it make sense to host your own version control? And, you know, if it goes down or has any issues, the entire company engineering org is paused.
Right. Yeah. Like if GitHub Enterprise, you know, if GitHub Cloud has an incident, you know, it's like, you know, you point the finger at them and then just moan about it, right?
Exactly. But go to Twitter about it.
Yeah, but if Enterprise Server goes down, it's like, Darren, you know, kind of, you know, what the heck, like, fix this. And I'm like, you know, up at 3 a.m. So you know, yeah. There's definitely a lot of conversation around, is this, are we just talking here? Is this, do you want me to do a POC?
It goes down, but sometimes it's good to get a coffee break. Sometimes, you know,
yeah,
not bad. But it does bring up a bigger question also, as we have more and more tooling, especially in GitOps, especially around automation and deployments and all of these other things. When GitHub goes down, it is now the weakest link. And there's a member of our team who's been pretty also vocal about this, that, you know, we should have a solution or story around what happens if GitHub is down and how do we work around it. I've been pushing back on that because I feel like it's just, it is a serious issue that's raised, but it's also a very complicated thing to try and seek to replace. And unless there's significant need coming from your customers, in this case, your engineers or something, to support an alternative method, I wouldn't touch it.
I concur. And like, ultimately, at the end of the day for us, you know, the way we build our CI is we just heavily rely on make files. And so it's like, hey, you know, if you really need to build and deploy, just make build and make publish and make deploy.
Yeah.
Right. So at least for our deployment, we have Argo CD now rather than GitHub Actions, yeah, using Helm templates. But for the CI, for the builds, it's very much something I'm interested in trying to roll out.
Something I, in 2020 hindsight, and I'm not 100% convinced of this, but in 2020 hindsight, one thing I think I'd like to explore for us in our Argo CD implementation is, today we use a separate GitHub, we still use, and we would use in a future implementation as well, a separate deployment repository. So a repository that hosts all the manifests that you want to deploy. But today our solution uses GitHub for that. Maybe we should have just, since we're predominantly AWS shop, maybe we should have used AWS code commit for that, so that there's always this deployable repository managed on AWS, totally disjointed from GitHub. And yeah, we use GitHub and Actions and all of that to validate and create manifests that we ultimately commit to the deployment repository. But why does that deployment repository have to sit on GitHub? I think using code commit is a perfect usage of code commit. I hate code commit as a product. It is not a GitHub alternative, but it is a great VCS just for like API
supports,
you know, AWS integrations, IAM capabilities.
Is there a tooling out there that like allows you to sync between VCSs? Is that a thing?
Oh yeah, there's tooling for it to in varying degrees. You know, depending on where how you're trying to do the sync. Like if you were using GitLab, it has that built into it. GitHub doesn't have it built in, but there are GitHub Actions that will do that. I'm sure
you'd have to roll out your own code or something.
Right? Yeah, to do that. Anyone have suggestions on this one? How to sync? I don't think that well, at least in our how we approach it. Or we don't, the manifests we deploy are never in the same repository as the application. So in our case,
that's for us too. We just have a single deployment, which I think is the best way to do it, right? We could talk about deployment approaches, but having a single repository where all of your charts and templates and values file that are, you know, GitOps approach based, and you can add, you know, instead of trying to manage access with regards to like, hey, like, you know, you can't merge a PR that changes a prod values YAML unless it requires this. That's easier just to do in one repo than like across, you know, 20, 30, 50 application repos.
Agreed.
Oh yeah, there you go.
Yeah, 3 years
just ago. Just a Lambda function, is that what it is?
Yeah. I was looking, I thought that AWS had maybe rolled out something more formal to replicate it. Yeah. I think that would make a lot of sense for AWS to do that. I think if AWS had a way just to replicate GitHub repos, a lot of companies would just use it as a DR source.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Into it and allowing AWS to charge for it. So. But yeah, I don't see a formal implementation.
You know, it's you've heard of, you know, going multi-cloud, but have you gone multi-VCS? you know?
Yeah, exactly. Terraform code. All right. Well, I'm not going to research here, but looks like people are thinking about it at least. So this is old here. Yeah, Q&A. All right. Let's see. Was there a question here in the Slack I see from Shri? Hello. Question regarding the GitHub Action workflows. Looking at the workflow triggers, event-based, scheduled, and manual. Notice that scheduled and manual-based triggers have a requirement that the workflow file is on the default branch, correct? Which makes development comply with branch protection rules, etc., difficult. But from the looks of it, it isn't the case with event triggers. Just thinking about the security implications, thinking of a scenario where folks can create a branch X and set up a workflow with the trigger to push to branch X, and then a workflow can access the repo and secrets and then underlying runners trigger. Okay, so Shri, are you on the call today? Should check that. Yeah, first.
GitHub has controls around that. If you go to the settings tab of your repository under the action section, you can control, like, if someone forks a repo, does that trigger your workflow? You can make it GitHub team based, so only this team, if they make a PR, will that trigger the workflow? I think it's pretty.
This is slightly different though, or I interpret it slightly differently, which is for development purposes, that if you are developing a GitHub Action workflow and the triggers that workflow depends on requires it to be in your default branch, how do you develop that workflow? So I was just going to share what we've had to do in that situation. It's not the best answer. It's one of two things. One is, well, if you're already an admin of the repo and it's a small team, small company, whatever, just temporarily change your default branch while you're developing it to your branch when you're doing the development. That gets around that hack, but that doesn't work in a real, you know, busy development environment, lots of people working on it. So shy of that, your option is really to clone that repo and develop in that other repository your workflows until you get them working. You can use other types of events, as you mentioned, and some of those events will work in pull requests. The issue then is depending on the events that you're using, the metadata available to you is different. So
The context are... sometimes that can be a bit tricky. Yeah. I do the second approach, which is just fork it to you know, your test repo for that workflow, and then make your changes, and then you can even merge that forked repo into your PR of the main repo. So
I don't have an idea for more on that. All right, next questions here. Any?
How's your day going, Eric?
It's going well. I'm actually in Paris, France this week. So visiting a buddy of mine, Sebastian. He's also one of the founders of Scalar. So one of the taco providers out there. Actually, he's the guy that came up with tacos. So... a lot of people attribute it to me, but it was never me. It was Sebastian. But yeah, here until Saturday, having a good time. And awesome. Glad to make it.
Yeah, I noticed your background was different. I was...
exactly.
You're usually in that. Yeah, your office. I have another question if nobody else has one. I don't want to take up all the time here.
Yeah, go for it.
The technology is called Cloudflare Tunnels for Zero Trust, Reverse Proxy, but ultimately it's not a product question. It's more of a kind of architecture question. So what we want to do is we have zero public IPs, right, anywhere. And we rely on this reverse tunnel technology to expose our, you know, publicly accessible web pages. And the current approach I have right now is I have multiple Kubernetes clusters. And within those Kubernetes clusters, I have a deployment of those tunnels, right? So like each Kubernetes cluster will have like five. And then there's some auto scaling. And I've been thinking about whether or not it would be better just to have a single VPC that has the tunnel connection across multiple AZs and then tunnel those connections through VPC peering to those, downstream Kubernetes cluster. But instead of, because the tunnel pod is within the Kubernetes cluster, we would have the ingress via an NLB that the service Kubernetes services would attach to. So I think both approaches seem fine. You could argue that maybe there's a couple extra hops with the, a dedicated Cloudflare VPC, essentially. I don't know, yeah. Just any thoughts or opinions or?
Well, I have an opinion on it just from my preference is that I don't like the centralized ingress or egress approach other than from a compliance perspective. I think mm-hmm. it's nice from a compliance perspective because it's one place to control what goes in and what goes out. And if you need to set up things that monitor that, I don't like it from an operations perspective because it's a thing I would never want to personally have to touch. If you're running a single AWS organization, so to say, and doing it that way. Now, an elegant solution I've seen another company do is they create different AWS organizations for dev staging and production. And then you can have a centralized ingress and egress that way. So you have a way to test changes right before. So otherwise, I like the simplicity of the approach you're taking. I didn't hear you say this, but the slight nuance or the way I've seen it done. Now, this was how for some period of time, Cloudflare actually had their own Argo ingress controller, but they deprecated it.
It is left to rot. I made a issue in there, and it's like three. It's like two. Yeah, they had a ingress.
Yeah.
They had a Helm chart, right, for it, and then it's been like two or three years,
But I reasoned the reason why it's totally unnecessary. Is really all you need is a service deployed or an additional pod deployed alongside your ingress controller, and you can modify any ingress you want to have that. So you can now deploy the Argo tunnel alongside your ingress and then just connect those two directly. And I kind of like that.
So yeah, that's what we do is I have one Cloudflare. The Cloudflare tunnel configuration points at a single Ingress Nginx deployment. And then Nginx is where we configure the hosts and the to point to which service.
So I like that. The only other thing I would react to then is then using Ingress Nginx is that the open source version, right, is pretty inefficient in the sense that every single time a pod in the cluster is added or destroyed, Nginx is reloaded, which is forking the process.
They had some issues with a memory leak around that. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's not even memory leak. It's just a pretty insane thing is that every single time a pod in the cluster is added to the load balancer, a new process, because it's not using an API to update Nginx because the API is only available in their enterprise version, the paid version.
Oh, I did not know that, but that is something I'll have to investigate. So I haven't seen any huge issues, but.
Yeah, there's never any issues at a small scale and this is, I don't know like if things have changed in the last 2 years, but at least up until at least 2 years ago, that was the truth of how Ingress Nginx.
Yeah, that's actually partially the reason why I wanted to see if I can do the NLB approach is what with the AWS load balancer controller, we can actually get rid of Ingress manifest altogether because then you have your service manifest with the annotations to populate itself as a target group to the NLB. Right. So you're reducing a hop. Nginx is always going to be, I think, a bit more of an overhead than just an extra network hop, especially if it's layer four.
Yeah.
But you know, kind of thinking on your question or what your recommendation was, what if I just have the EC2 servers for the Cloudflare, you know, just inside of the VPC for that environment, and then just point that at the NLB, right? And then that gets rid of, I guess, you know, a single point of failure, but as well as enables upgrades to Cloudflare.
Did I hear EC2 instances though? I didn't.
Yes, well, exactly. That's the difference, right? So it would be EC2 instances that then point to the singular NLB. That singular NLB has target groups for each of your Kubernetes services.
Okay, you're talking about it in the centralized ingress model, ingress VPC.
Not centralized to a given environment, but not centralized for all of the environments across multiple. So a cluster of Cloudflare tunnels per Kubernetes cluster.
Yeah.
And the reason why for that is
I'm the cluster itself though. I don't understand.
Yes. Yeah. I probably should have led with this, which is because of the way I probably could fix this, but the way that I have Carpenter set up right now, you know, it's either set to expire. And so the pods will die for Cloudflare. And so we lose connectivity for like a short period of time when Carpenter is spinning up the new node and then placing the tunnels.
We learned this the hard way relatively recently with a customer and updated our reference architecture as a result of it. We were deploying Carpenter under Fargate and then 100% of the workloads just on nodes managed by Carpenter. But it was a little bit too volatile for sensitive controllers. Things like getting core DNS scheduled on something that is, you know, could be unstable really sucks because your entire cluster loses basically connectivity between services if core DNS goes down. So right. So there are two paths you can take. One is just make darn sure you are annotating anything that you don't want to be bouncing around with something so it runs on Fargate, do our second recommendation, which is provision traditional AWS managed node pools, static size, no auto scaling for all your sensitive services like that.
Yeah, like the operator and controller pods, right?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. I thought you were also going to bring up the capability of Carpenter to have different provisioners.
Mm. So
one thing I'm trying to do, and I think it's somewhat working, but maybe still a bit flaky, is with the action runner controllers, because sometimes we have zero runners, sometimes we have 20, 30. And every time those pods get placed or deleted, that triggers Carpenter to to consolidate. And we saw that level of tenancy was really affecting neighboring pods. And so I created a separate provisioner. And so Carpenter, you know, keeps those apart.
We are using that, I know, as well. In our case, an actions runner controller was actually we ran into issues related to that as well. In our case, we have a separate account always for automation and a separate cluster. So all of that is never running concurrent on the same clusters that run workloads for any customer apps.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I do is I have dev, like stage and prod, and then I have a separate EKS cluster for like infrastructure DevOps tools like Argo CD and workflows.
Yeah.
So the noisy neighbors were internal tools, but nevertheless, your internal tools need to be, you know, stable as well.
Yeah.
Try to keep costs down, you know, don't create more clusters, but like you want to kind of create more clusters, especially if it's like, you know, if we're using workflows or Argo CD heavily, then at what level does it necessitate, like, you know, we need to eat the cost I mean, which honestly, it's like what, 30, 40 bucks a month for your own, you know, cluster. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's some argument back and forth around what, you know, what's kind of the good approach, the good middle ground, and when do we reevaluate?
Yeah. I guess next questions. Feel free to re-ask or ask additional questions if you have any more. Oh, by the way, Mark Tamsky, yeah, just thanks. I see you, Darren, just saw Mark posted in the channel. You can dynamically create tunnel binding CRDs for each of your services.
That sounds really cool. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not, actually, could someone tell me more about tunnel binding?
They are a resource that the Cloudflare operator enables, the Adyanth link just prior to that.
So there were two links. Is that part of the Bees Labs or is that part of Adyanth?
Two different Cloudflare tunnel implementations as an operator pattern in Kubernetes.
Got it.
And we kind of evaluated them both, and this one seems more mature.
Sorry, which one's this one?
The second.
The one I have open?
Yeah, the one that's open. And if you scroll down, there's a pretty good documentation link within it that kind of shows the...
Dude, you might have just saved me.
Bird's eye view. The bird's eye view picture down low in that README. Okay. There.
Okay, interesting. So it dynamically creates the tunnels. Is that what I'm seeing? I could be wrong, but company is a little, you know, tight on the purse strings sometimes. I think like there's a limitation on number of tunnels, right? For your Cloudflare account, is it like 10 or something?
I think it's higher than that.
Is it more? Okay,
I'm pretty positive it's higher than that. I can go look, but. Cloudflare doesn't have a limits page like AWS does.
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with Cloudflare about purchasing enterprise because I wanted to like do the approach where we use Cloudflare load balancers and Cloudflare tunnels. And then, dude, they were like, they're like, okay, so the first like 10 tunnels are free. I have a list somewhere, but it's like the first 10 are free. And then between 10 and 20 is 40 bucks a month under, like, you can just purchase them ad hoc. And then if you go to enterprise, the price per tunnel jumps up to 250 per tunnel per month. And then if you go above a certain threshold, they give you a bulk discount. So it drops down to like 80 bucks a month. But it's like, yeah, man, if you have like a tunnel CRD, what I'm thinking is like, if you have a tunnel CRD per service, and that constitutes a new tunnel, what does that look like? Or maybe we just have one tunnel CRD, right? Because that's kind of what I'm doing anyways.
You can definitely overload them the way you're doing them now.
Good point, yeah. But yeah, no, I'll definitely look into this. I appreciate it, Mark. Thanks.
Hope it helps.
Mark, this is interesting. What are you working on lately that led you down this path?
A need for exposing internal resources to employees only, and having multiple individual services like an Argo CD endpoint and a Prometheus endpoint, things like that.
Are you also using Cloudflare's Access product then?
The Access application, Cloudflare Access application CRD is also declared by this operator as well. So,
oh, cool. So this handles,
access groups and
something really cool, Mark, that unfortunately isn't supported in containers, I think, unless I like hack it myself, is are you using the Warp client by any chance?
Using the which?
So Cloudflare, as part of the Cloudflare Zero Trust offering, which includes tunnels, there's Warp client.
Yes.
Okay.
There's both. We're using both in different ways. Like Cloudflare Warp is for public access. Is that right?
No, it's, yeah. So Warp is for private, because then private. You can whitelist.